It is 21 minutes after the hour, and it's Tuesday, and of course that means a visit from Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and a vintner, and he's resides in Garden Valley, Texas, where he's self-quarantined. You're not locked down over there, are you, Don?
No, we're not locked down, per se.
Yeah.
We're on, the restaurants are on 25%. The capacity, and
I don't know how they make it.
A lot of restaurants are still choosing just to do curbside service because they can't handle just 25%.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much of a burden for them. Our tasting room is open, and
I gotta wonder about having a wine tasting room on the side. You're in a beautiful location, but how's traffic on that highway? There just aren't a lot of cars out and around.
No, there aren't. And so we don't have the volume of people, which is probably a good thing. Volume of people that we could be having at this time of year had this been a, in quote, normal year. But apparently it's, it is what it is.
And you got that pretty new veranda. Is that what you call that?
It's a big pavilion. It's about 30 feet by almost 40 feet.
You get to sit outside, you have picnic tables, and sometimes you have music there and barbecues and all that's gotta, hopefully that's gonna resurrect itself here real soon, because Texas is opening up again.
Yes, so hopefully we do have a an event planned in June, but we're kind of taking it week by week to see, one, if there's interest in people coming, but two, is this something that others are doing or that, we feel safe, doing. So
That seems to be one of the things that a lot of people are worrying about. Will people show up? For example, movie theaters. I feel strongly that the best thing we can do is to develop an immunity to this thing as fast as possible. But at the same time, I want somebody else to do it.
To be immune.
You guys go and do that, and I'll be right behind you.
Okay, and then then you'll come and stay down here opposed to staying where you are.
Just so happens that Don, as a biochemist, worked for years in the pharmaceutical industry, and it was just a couple of weeks ago that we deviated from our normal topic of biblical creation, and we started talking about science. And Don, we kind of like to do that again today. And I have a question for you. In fact, David and I were just talking earlier about how scientific discovery, that is, that I'm imagining this to be pure science, where you research stuff and you find something unusual and something useful, and then you got to turn it into money somehow. So at some point, it seems to me that objectivity leaks out of the science. What's the difference between pure science and applied science?
Let's take a very common example, something that folks can relate to. So let's say you're a physical chemist or you're a physical scientist, and you want to know, what's the relationship for if I heat up water, for example, what's the physical properties and what are their relationship to one another? So if you heat up water, that it starts absorbing energy, obviously, and things start happening inside the water molecules and between the water molecules. If you want to, let's say we want to constrain one of the parameters. So let's say we constrain, the volume in which the water is in. So we put it in a container and we start, and it's a closed container, a very tightly closed container. so nothing is leaking out. And then we stick a pressure probe in it, and we start heating it up, and we know what the temperature of the water is because we've got a temperature probe in the water, and then we run our experiment. So we're measuring pressure and we're measuring temperature so as that, we're heating
is,
it up.
This is about gathering data.
It is. And so you can imagine now that you've got your pressure temperature profile, if you will, and you know how much energy you're putting in, so all of that then you can use to define what the relationship is between pressure and temperature and amount of energy that you're putting in. And then you can come and say, okay, let me change something else. And perhaps, perhaps you change something else. And then as you're heating the water up, let's say instead of being in a confined space, now you're heating the water up and you're measuring the temperature. And you notice that as the water gets to the boiling point, the temperature doesn't change. You keep adding energy into the system. You keep heating it up, and the water keeps absorbing the heat. But nothing's happening to the temperature. The temperature's remaining constant. And so you go along for a while, until all the water has evaporated, and then you don't have anything, you know, to measure anymore. but other than the humid, you know, atmosphere that was above the water, and so you notice that the water absorbed a certain amount of energy for a certain volume of water in order to evaporate the water. So there was the heat of evaporation, for example. That process took heat, and you know, because you've measured it several times, and you've got different instruments for doing that, you know how much energy, you know, it absorbed. And
could you make a model that would describe that phenomenon?
Oh, yeah, and they have. It is. I mean, the first description, the equation, and we're talking, when you say model, it's usually an equation. So the mathematical equation would be PV, pressure times volume, is equal to R, a constant, times temperature, which is T. So PV equals RT. That is the model that came out of that experiment that I described. And that model works until you get to the boiling point of water, which also, by the way, depends on the pressure above it. Mm-hmm. So that's at atmospheric pressure. You know, we know that water boils, and this is how you define a thermometer. It boils at 100 degrees Celsius. And you then have to take into account the amount of energy that the water absorbs when it boils, and you know, you can do that very easily.
What you're describing to me is objectivity, but in terms of designing the experiment, there's some creativity. I mean, there's some other kind of external information apart from your data that you have to apply. You have to say, well, what can I change to achieve? Usually this is done with an objective in mind, though. You're gathering data, and then you reach a point where that data needs to be useful for some reason. And I'm relating this to COVID-19 and all the research that's going on for vaccines and therapeutics and gathering data from people who have contracted the virus. And there's these models, some of which are early models that prove to be wrong. Some may prove to be more right than others, but you begin to discard models until you hopefully, ultimately, get one that's accurate and right on target. So you can use it to either describe what has happened in the past or what's happening now, or it's predictive of the future. And then what? Do you sell it?
Well, no, hopefully you can use it to predict some other type of viral infection. And that's the thing. I mean, we probably had models, and I'm saying probably because I haven't done the research on it. We probably had models for a flu infection in the population. Now you're talking about population statistics, which is different than what the experiment type of experiment I just described. And there you might start off with making some assumptions, for example. And what type of assumptions can we make? Well, the first assumption is let's figure out how many people are going to be infected. And how quickly are they going to be affected? Okay, well, we have previous flu models, and if this virus acts like the previous flu infections, then based on the previous flu infections, we have come up with the modeling maybe a normal distribution if the population is behaving similarly.
Is the assumption there that all viruses will have certain characteristics in common and behave?
Well, initially, that's what you have to assume, because you don't know anything about this virus, right? So you don't know how many people or how quickly it's going to affect people. Is the infection rate greater in the population, or is it less? When does the virus start expressing itself? In other words, when do you start getting sick? That may be different. You don't know any of those things in the beginning, so you take your best shot and say, well, based on previous knowledge of infections of viruses, maybe one in three. If one person is sick, they will infect three other people. And now you've infected three people. Well, those three people go on to infect three people on an average.
That seems to me almost total chance, because how do you know that this person comes in contact with it's like an average, isn't it? I mean, it may not apply to any specific individual or group of individuals.
Right, it's a statistical model. It's an average. It's on the average, one person will infect three people, or one person will infect four people. But, you know, let's say based on the experience of flu infections, you found out that, okay, one person will infect on an average three people, and we know within what time frame that is. Let's say that's within within 2 weeks, so you have a time factor, then you have the number of people that infects, and then in a general population that are going about doing their own thing, then how this disease is going to progress.
Okay, and this is leading to the question I really want to ask. Now you can introduce another variable. You've got this model. Does it hold in a warm climate the same way it holds in a cooler climate or a damp climate or at altitude? How do you make that information useful for helping people?
Well, that's you see, the more historic data you have, the better you can start answering some of these questions. Because if you just take the data across the United States, for example, let's use that as an example, then and not subpopulate it by saying, okay, we know that the flu in Florida propagates itself, in this manner, but the flu in North Dakota may propagate, quite differently, because in the winter people are pretty much shut up anyway. whereas in Florida they're still out, playing, and people, they might be on the beaches or just even walking around. You're not necessarily going to be swimming, but there may be outdoor activities, and so life goes on as normal in Florida, but not so much when you've got 10, 20, 30 inches of snow and it's minus 40 degrees outside. So Obviously, you know, temperature is going to be going to affect this. Plus, there's a lot of variables here. That's why you do population statistics, because there's so many variables that it is it's very difficult. Now, assuming you even know that based on you have accurate, semi-accurate or population data from previous flu infections, now you throw on top of that, well, you know, this, you know, people, if people get infected with this flu, oh my goodness, we're seeing that they might not show infections for, you know, it might be 3 days, but in the worst case, it might be 2 weeks. We don't know if they're infected for 2 weeks because they're not expressing any symptoms of being ill. That was one thing that was different about this virus than previous viruses, for example. People usually, once you get infected, you usually express something within a shorter period of time. So this was expressing in a lot of people later than what you would normally anticipate for a flu. So that disrupts your normal model anyway. And then let's throw on top of that, we're going to shut down everything, right? And now your population isn't the same anymore, because you have people, you know, a good percentage of the people in the population not going anywhere, not doing their normal thing. So in a statistical model, all bets are off at that point, and you've totally disrupted the normal behavior of your population. And so you don't know how to model that. And therein lies the problem. If you're assuming that people are acting on their own, you know, that like they acted before, but you've changed the environment so that they're not acting like they did before, the only thing you can do is use some type of mechanical statistical model saying that, as I've seen, let's say on Facebook, you've seen these pictures of a ball hitting another ball, and that ball hits another ball, and then after a period of time, you've got all the balls being hit and changing colors, right? Well, if you take away balls from your experiment, you got less balls to hit, and statistically, the one ball is going to take longer to hit another ball, so therefore, you kind of, as was described, you spread out the curve, if you will, or you not necessarily flatten it, but you just elongate, the bell distribution. So everybody's seen a bell curve, mm-hmm. right? So yep. A lot of this is from a statistical point of view can be described as a bell curve. Well, you can take that bell curve and you can stretch it out. In other words, the same number of people are going to get infected, but we're going to stretch that out. So now it's a flatter bell curve than a nice sharp peaked bell curve. And that's what they were hoping
flatten
to do.
Flatten the curve, but, yeah. But now how do we, because we've got, there's so many voices barking at us about what's safe and what's not, what's right. You wear masks, don't wear masks. You take hydroxychloroquine, you don't. The science is getting awfully confused. So for those elements in our society here that say, trust the science, let science make the decision, you know, base everything on what scientists tell you, I've got to say, which one? Which scientist? You know.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's because so much is unknown. I mean, we've known from 1950, for example, that hydroxychloroquine is useful as an antiviral. So that information is not new. So you had some folks and saying, hey, why not, let's try it and let's see what happens. it's worked previously. What do we have to lose? It's a relatively innocuous drug. Yes, okay, there's some heart problems with some patients, not many. But other than that, it's used in the general population for not only malaria, which it was designed for initially, but also for lupus, which is an autoimmune disease. So let's talk about this for a moment. Just that one drug. So we have a Jewish doctor in New York, for example, who comes out and says, I've treated 600 and plus patients, and nobody's died with this particular protocol. And the protocol involved zinc, taking hydroxychloroquine, and a very common antibiotic. And if you give your patients these symptoms, they don't go to the, I don't send them to the hospital. I send them home with five tablets of this and four, you know, eight tablets of this, and everybody here, take this for 5 days. And if you continue to have symptoms, come back and see me. And he said, I've had great success with that treatment. And then you have, in quote, the pure scientists, the pure clinicians, because I was in clinical studies. I conducted clinical studies, so I know how this works. And I know what the FDA normally requires, that you show a clinical benefit, but it's got to be a well-controlled clinical study, which means a well-controlled clinical study means that you've got the drugged group, not that people are on drugs, but they're taking your treatment, and you have the control group, and they're taking a placebo. So they're taking a sugar tablet while the other person is taking the real medicine. Well, that's a hard thing to do in a situation where you could possibly have people die. And so the next best thing you can do is have kind of a control group where people aren't treating with that particular drug. They're just treating it with, you know, whatever normal medicine that they can treat with, and putting people on ventilators and such, this other group is treating with the hydroxychloroquine zinc antibiotic, and then you compare the two groups after a period of time. I mean, you got to collect enough data, and usually enough data means thousands of patients. Thousands. It could be 20,000 patients that you need to collect in order to have a statistical, depending on the difference between the two groups, in order to say that this is statistically significant. That's what a lot of people were crying about. We need those well-controlled studies before we can say it's safe to take the, you know, hydroxychloroquine to treat this virus. Now, and which group is right? Well, you have to weigh the risk. You know, you have to weigh the potential benefit to the patient, and you have to weigh the risk to the patient of what you're taking.
Okay, now is that a scientific call, or is that a political call? Is it an economic call? Because there's these other factors too. You know, who's responsible for making the decisions and enforcing a mode of behavior on the American public? Can we just throw it in the lap of science and say, you know what you're doing, you take over?
Oh, well, yeah, no, you can't. That's the problem. You know, that's the problem here, because those are soft decisions. There is no model to say, okay, this is a, in quote, safe drug, and so therefore we can use it. But in this case, we had years and years of experience with this drug in a general population, and we knew that it was a pretty safe, as far as drugs go, it's a pretty safe drug. And so there isn't this thing, you know, that you're dealing with a new drug where you don't know the safety profile. right? So you do certain types of clinical experiments.
Is the issue here that you don't know if it's safe if you have COVID-19, where it might be safe because it's been used for 40 years in other situations? So in other words, does COVID-19 add some risk to the use of hydroxychloroquine?
Well, I don't think that was
non-factor. Maybe.
You know, does it compound the disease? For example, it had been used. You got to recall in this case, it had been used in China with reported success. It had been used in Europe, in particular France, with some success. It had been used in Italy with some success. And so, you know, people, you know, are getting sick anyway, if you will. And this is, in quote, a relatively new use for the drug, although it wasn't, because it had been used as an antiviral for flu before. And so then you kick in the political realm. You know, okay, we have a drug that's relatively safe. We know that the safety, we know exactly what the safety profile is. We know which patients might be at a little bit of risk from this drug, so maybe we should monitor those patients a little more closely. We knew all of that. We knew that it had some success in some viral situations, the type of virus this was, for example. So why not? Why not use it? Mm-hmm. And then you had all these, the outcry that said, well, we don't have these controlled clinical studies. And you know what? Sometimes you just don't need those type of studies to move forward to see if there's a benefit, because we have all of these anecdotal studies, for example, that were saying, hey, it looks like it's showing some benefit. And if you want the statistical data, then okay, go fund a study and contract with doctors around the country and say, hey, we'll give you, you know, $5,000 a patient or $10,000 or $20,000 a patient to study this, which is typically the price, by the way, for a clinical study, depending on how long it is, if not more. Mm-hmm.
You bring in another factor, and then there is observational data, and then there's anecdotal data. And why is it that in this vast array of objectively accumulated data over time, that somehow that outweighs anecdotal data, which is probably a lot deeper experience than the scientifically gathered data, because we're watching people, seeing how they behave, and seeing results. And it's logic, but it's not mathematical, if you know what I mean. It's imprecise.
Well,
that doesn't make it inaccurate.
No, and it doesn't make it not useful. Because the data that had been presented was what's called retrospective studies. That is, you treat with this regimen, and then you kind of go back instead of doing it prospective, where you set the study up. You kind of go back and say, okay, you know, what happened in this patient population? Now, I just want to make one other point, which I think is the critical point here, is that if you have a new drug, right, a new drug, you don't know what the safety profile is. And so you need to do well-controlled clinical studies to find out first and foremost what the safety profile is. And then secondly, you ask the efficacy question. That is the drug effective? And so here, we knew exactly what the safety profile was, and we knew that the risks were very low from a safety point of view. So we didn't have to ask that question anymore. The point was, is it effective? And that the answer to that question was we don't know exactly, but it seems like, based on the anecdotal data, based on the retrospective data, it might be, so let's go ahead and use it.
And to go back to your water experiment, you've just demonstrated to us that when the political pressure goes up, so does the temperature of the debate.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dr. Don is a biochemist, again, a member of the Board of Creation Moments. You might want to check their website out, creationmoments.com. It's really a wonderful resource, an archive of scientific information that supports and explains the biblical story of creation. So creationmoments.com, give them a whirl. And Don, thank you so much. I feel like I've learned something today. Usually happens when I talk to you.
It's been interesting. Yeah, thank you.
See you next week.
Welcome. All righty, folks. You all have a great week.
See you next week.